down, which has been a tradition of American diplomacy, but also one of its greatest failures, because all they do is they go around telling people, calm down, take it easy, the proportional response, don't let this expand. But at the same time, they keep feeding Israel with all of the military means it needs to keep the situation tense and including constant military exchange, especially with Hezbollah and Israel. So really what this reminds us, that the whole context of Palestinian-Israeli, Arab-Israeli, Hezbollah-Israeli, Iran-Israeli, whatever you want to look at, has not worked very well. There has been no serious diplomacy that tries to address the underlying causes and resolve them. And they're all resolvable. These are human, man-made, woman-made issues that can be resolved by human beings. But the United States is not able to mediate impartially, except on a few technical issues here and there, like the oil leases and things like that. But on issues that are dear to Zionism, which is, you know, to assert its authority in the region, the U.S. is fully on the Israeli side. And this is one of the problems that we have.
Well, Rami Kouri, I want to thank you for being with us. There's clearly much more to talk about it, and we will over the coming days. Palestinian-American journalist, senior public policy fellow at American University of Beirut, also non-resident senior fellow at the Arab Center in Washington. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a director of development to lead our fundraising team. Learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
You are tuned into KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO has a mobile app. You can listen to all your favorite shows, subscribe to KBOO podcasts, even set KBOO as your alarm clock. Just look for KBOO on the iTunes and Google Play Store. And don't forget to leave us a 5-star review.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right ready.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland area officials define how new drug deflection programs will operate.
Oregon high schoolers will soon have a financial literacy requirement to graduate.
And a new study says breathing in wildfire smoke could increase the risk of dementia.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 29th, 2024. I'm Sabine.
And I'm Grant Button. Nearly 4 months after an Oregon House bill overhauled Measure 110, its drug decriminalization effort, a key term in that new law, finally has a definition. HB 4002 introduced a new Class E misdemeanor charge for drug possession. It undid a key provision in Measure 110, which reduced possession of small amounts of hard drugs from a criminal offense to an $100 fine. Under the new bill, which takes effect September 1st, Class E offenders face a potential jail time unless they submit to, quote, deflection. On Friday, Multnomah County finally released its guidelines for deflection, clearing up what exactly that meant. Class E violators can avoid jail if they agree to a screening, get a referral for treatment, and engage with the service recommended by the screening. All this has to happen within 30 days of getting the citation. Only people who violate the law are eligible for a deflection program. Anyone who gets another citation within 30 days of a previous deflection faces arrest. The guidelines were drafted in a closed-door meeting of Portland area officials, including Multnomah County Chair Jessica Vega Peterson, Portland and Gresham Police Chiefs, directors from the Multnomah County Health Department, representatives of Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler, as well as outgoing District Attorney Mike Schmidt. Incoming District Attorney Nathan Vasquez did not attend, though county officials said in a statement, quote, his concerns were considered, end quote.
Some county commissioners are still unsatisfied. Commissioner Sharon Murin questioned unspecified terms that still loom in the definition provided Friday. At the meeting, she asked, what kind of screening? What is being screened for? What does engaged with the service mean? The language around deflection is now established, but the physical infrastructure to support it is still largely absent. Multnomah County has renovated an old printing plant on Southeast Sandy Boulevard as a temporary deflection center. The center will start deflection services next year, with a permanent center expected at another location in 2026. Oregonians approved the nation's first all-drug decriminalization measure with a 58% majority in 2020. Yet Measure 110's rollout was impeded by unforeseen circumstances like the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as the inevitable introduction of fentanyl into the Oregon illegal drug market. Measure 110 expanded public health services considerably, but state lawmakers ceded to old arguments about the dangers of letting drug users go unpunished. And it appears HB 4002 may contribute little to impacting drug use in Oregon. The drug deflection programs that are referenced in the law are optional for counties to create. A Portland State University report released this year shows that only a fraction of people with substance use disorder came in contact with the criminal justice system. The report reiterated the significance of community outreach programs like those funded through Measure 110.
Oregon students will soon have to pass courses in financial literacy and career preparedness to graduate from high school. More than two dozen states have financial literacy course requirements, although in Oregon, the move saw some pushback. Mason Kennedy has the details.
Oregon high schoolers in the class of 2027 can expect a new financial literacy course on their schedules. The class on personal finance, along with a class on career preparation, will be required for graduation, after the Oregon School Board sided with legislators this summer. Opponents of the requirement included teachers' unions and school boards who wanted these lessons to be integrated into other classes. Proponents like Pam Levitt with Go West Credit Union Association say these skills are important enough to focus on in separate courses.
It's not an area of focus within the schools that should be done in an elective. Every single student should graduate and understand their personal finances.
Levitt cites a 2023 survey from the National Financial Educators Council that found more than 60% of adults in the U.S. had lost at least $500 that year alone due to a lack of knowledge about personal finance, with the average lost over $1,500. She says the required courses should help students avoid mistakes that she often sees working with financial institutions. Levitt works with credit unions across the West and says she's seen recent graduates struggle with credit cards, home loans, and student debt. Not every person has the resources to learn about budgeting on their own, so she's convinced the course requirement will help students of all backgrounds to achieve financial security.
This is what was lacking when students were graduating. They need these basic life skills, and every student in our state needs them.
While school requirements have varied over the years, Levitt says Oregon credit unions have worked to fill in the gaps by providing financial assistance when possible. Oregon joins more than two dozen other states in requiring a financial literacy course to graduate. For Oregon News Service, I'm Mason Kennedy.
Last Friday, the director of the Portland Water Bureau resigned at the request from City Commissioner Mingus Mapps. On June 28th, City Commissioner Mingus Mapps put the director of the Portland Water Bureau, Gabe Solmer, on administrative leave. It was his last day overseeing the Portland Water Bureau, and the reasoning behind his decision was not clear. In an interview with OPB, Gabe Solmer said that Mingus Maps told her she had done nothing wrong and offered her no other explanation. She was offered 21 days of paid leave to decide whether she wanted to accept the firing or to resign voluntarily. Under state law, bureau directors can be fired without explanation. But Solmer said she felt blindsided by the news, asking if she could stay and continue the work she loved, but being told no. She said, "The city is going through a lot right now, and if something as disruptive and destabilizing as this can happen to other bureaus without any explanation, it's not going to help." End quote. Gabe Solmer was the first woman to become the Portland Water Bureau's director and led for nearly 4 years with glowing performance reviews. She said in a written statement that, quote, "I have worked hard during my time at the Bureau to show that listening and collaborating with staff, respecting their expertise, and demonstrating transparency in decision-making all result in an effective Bureau. I wish the city would have shown as much respect and transparency with me during this transition process," end quote.
Iconic Portland drag bar Darcel 15 Showplace is at risk of closing after 57 years of service. In 1967, Walter Cole, better known by his drag persona Darcel 15, bought Demas Tavern in Old Town Portland and turned it into Darcel 15 Showplace. The club has been a home for the LGBTQ community in Portland for the last 57 years. Darcel performed up until her death last year at the age of 92. In the year since her death, attendance at Darcel 15 Showplace has declined. The club released a statement on Instagram Wednesday announcing the risk of closure and asking for community support. Darcel 15 Showplace is now run by Cole's daughter and son, who say it was their father's dying wish for the club to keep running as a piece of Portland history.
The Oregon Health Authority is tracking a new measles outbreak, according to a press release Friday. There are 19 confirmed cases of measles across Marion, Clackamas, Clatsop, and Multnomah counties. 18 of the confirmed cases are among people who have not received the measles vaccine. 3 people have been hospitalized due to complications with the disease. Health officials are encouraging unvaccinated individuals to get vaccinated and limit contact with people outside their household if symptoms develop.
Trump encourages his Christian supporters to vote possibly for the last time. Biden pushes for reforms to the Supreme Court. And an Ohio constitutional amendment to end gerrymandering qualifies for the November ballot. With more on the story is Catherine Carley with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Get out. You got to get out and vote. In 4 years, you don't have to vote again. We'll have it fixed so good you're not going to have to vote.
Former President Donald Trump faces backlash for comments to a right-wing Christian group saying they wouldn't ever need to vote again once he's reelected. Democrats charge that follows a pattern, threatening not to accept the results if he loses, and saying he'd be a dictator for the first day of a second term. But Republicans, including New Hampshire Governor Chris Sununu, say he's just using hyperbole.
We want everybody to vote in all elections, but I think he was just trying to make a hyperbolic point that it can be fixed as long as he gets back into office and all that. But, you know, classic Trump right there.
Project 2025, a second Trump term roadmap that the former president now denies, would radically increase the power of the president. President Joe Biden heads to Texas today, where he'll unveil plans for reforming the Supreme Court. He's expected to call for term limits for justices and an enforceable code of ethics. Justice Elena Kagan says that current lack of enforcement is a problem. She says one proposal would take ethics complaints to a panel of outside judges.
But I feel as though we, however hard it is, that we could and should try to figure out some mechanism for doing this.
Biden may also back a constitutional amendment to reverse a recent court ruling giving presidents criminal immunity for official acts. New York Democratic Congressman Joe Morelli has already introduced amendment language, which has more than 40 co-sponsors.
This isn't just about Donald Trump and the charges he faces. This is about the office of the presidency. This is about what Americans believe, and they believe every person should be held accountable.
If it passes Congress, 38 states would need to ratify it. An Ohio state constitutional amendment to end gerrymandering has officially qualified for the November ballot. It would take the power to draw district maps from a committee of lawmakers and give it to an independent bipartisan group of voters. Jen Miller with the group Citizens Not Politicians says Ohio is one of the most gerrymandered of all the states.
When politicians and lobbyists get to rig maps, it harms every Ohio voter and our democracy.
Seven different maps were struck down as unconstitutional by the state Supreme Court in 2022. The Ohio Ballot Board must now sign off on the amendment's language for it to be on the ballot. Meanwhile, Vote.org says it's had more than 100,000 new voter registrations since Vice President Kamala Harris entered the race, mostly from voters under 34. And Harris's campaign says it has raised almost $200 million. The election is now 100 days away. Finally, Democrats in North Carolina are challenging the state election board's decision to recognize a new political party and put Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on the state's presidential ballot. They allege the Kennedy campaign skirted the laws dealing with independent candidates. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in Depth. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather is cloudy with a low of 65. Tomorrow's weather is cloudy with a high of 76. Today in history, President Dwight D. Eisenhower signed into law the National Aeronautics and Space Act in 1958, which created NASA. Some of NASA's greatest accomplishments include the Apollo 11 mission, creating the first U.S. satellite in only 3 months, designing the Hubble Space Telescope, and much more. The quote of the day is from Edgar Dean Mitchell, a United States Navy officer and NASA astronaut. He was the lunar module pilot of Apollo 14 in 1971 and spent 9 hours working on the moon's surface. When referring to his Apollo 14 mission, he said, quote, "You develop an instant global consciousness, a people orientation, an intense dissatisfaction with the state of the world, and a compulsion to do something about it. From out there on the moon, international politics look so petty."
Two sacred sites on the Lac du Flambeau Reservation in Wisconsin have been subjected to destructive behavior by non-Native people. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Medicine Rock and Strawberry Island are two of the most sacred sites on the Lac du Flambeau Reservation in Wisconsin. Recently, there have been multiple reports of disrespectful and destructive behavior at both places by non-Native people. WXPR's Hannah Davis-Reed talked to elders in the community about the history and significance of the places.
Medicine Rock and Strawberry Island on Flambeau Lake are two of the most sacred places on the Lac du Flambeau Reservation. Medicine Rock, or Gishi Meshkiki in Ojibwe, has been held sacred for generations since Chief Kishkumen first brought the band to the area in 1745. He told his people that as long as they took care of and protected this rock, they'd be here. Carol Brown is an elder in the community and Chief Kishkumen's descendant on her father's side.
It's not a place for parties, it's not a place for picnics, although it's beautiful, and it's got a sandbar.
Strawberry Island, whose artifacts and remains have been dated back as far as 200 BC, is both the site of the last territorial battle between the Ojibwe and the Sioux in 1745, as well as a coerced land sale between the U.S. government and the Ojibwe. In 1887, the Dawes Act employed a divide-and-conquer strategy to assimilate Native communities by breaking down communally owned tribal land and parceling it out to individual tribal members who needed money to survive and ended up selling their land to homesteaders. Strawberry Island was eventually sold to the Mills family, who got approval for a subdivision plat on the island, which the tribe successfully fought against in court. Eventually, in 2014, the tribe bought Strawberry Island, and since then, they've kept it as a protected area, strictly not to be disturbed.
Our elders and our before then have told us, don't go onto the island, you need to respect that area, that's where spirits lie, and we've always respected that.
In a press release, the tribe said they're seeking solutions to avoid this issue in the future. I'm Hannah Davis Reed.
Tribal communities in the Mountain West will receive millions of dollars to invest in climate resiliency efforts and clean energy. Yvette Fernandez reports for the Mountain West News Bureau.
Tribal communities across the country are being allocated $45 billion for climate resiliency. This includes big projects such as improving community electric grids to creating solar, wind, and battery storage. It also includes providing households as much as $14,000 to upgrade appliances, says the Department of Energy's Matthew Dannenberg.
As our planet continues to warm, it is vitally important that access to clean energy, climate resiliency is available to everyone, and that tribes are not left behind.
Dannenberg says these funds also represent jobs and ensure decisions are being made with cultural awareness. These funds come from a variety of federal climate initiatives, such as the American Rescue Plan and Justice 40, which calls for allocating at least 40% of climate funds for tribes and other disenfranchised communities. I'm Yvette Fernandez.
The Navajo Nation Department of Health is recommending the use of masks indoors due to COVID-19. According to the department, the tribe is seeing a slight uptick of COVID cases on the reservation. The department has issued a COVID-19 health advisory notice and is asking people to take protective measures, which include staying up to date with COVID vaccines and wearing a mask when sick. Some hospitals on the reservation have resumed requiring masks in their facilities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Scientists say the drying Great Salt Lake in Utah is significantly contributing to greenhouse gas emissions. That's according to a new study conducted by Canada's Royal Ontario Museum. The drying comes from a number of factors, but it's mainly due to water diversions by farmers and Utah's booming population growth. Scientists tested 7 months of emissions in 2020. They found out that the Great Salt Lake has shrunk by nearly half in recent years. Soren Brothers helped lead the study. He said, "Human-caused desiccation of Great Salt Lake is exposing huge areas of lake bed and releasing massive quantities of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere." He also stated that lakes drying up is an issue that needs to be taken more seriously during climate change planning. The study found that the Great Salt Lake emitted over 4 million tons of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere in 2020 alone. That meant a 7% increase in Utah's human-caused emissions. Drying lake beds impact humans and animals, too. For example, researchers in Utah have begun to detect sharp declines in shorebird populations because their prey, brine shrimp, are dying out. Dust storms and air pollution are also a concern from dried lake beds, as well as the high concentration of neurotoxins and carcinogens present in the lake. In an effort to combat this, the state legislature has invested around $1 billion into water conservation programs in recent years, mostly geared toward farmers.
Wildfire smoke may be worse for brain health than other types of air pollution and could cause an increased risk of dementia. That's according to a new study reported today at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in Philadelphia. Fine particulate matter are tiny particles, approximately 30 times smaller than the diameter of a human hair, that come from pollution. When they're breathed in, they can cause or worsen heart and lung diseases. Now, a new study indicates that these particles are also linked to an increased risk of dementia. Researchers tracked health records from over 1 million older adults in Southern California over a 10-year span to estimate their exposure to fine particulate matter. They found that the odds of dementia increased about 21% for every 1 microgram increase in the concentration of wildfire particles. Non-wildfire particles are said to increase the risk of dementia by 3% for every 3 micrograms. This research comes at a time when millions of Americans experienced air quality warnings this past weekend from wildfire, and as wildfires continue to become more prevalent worldwide due to global warming.
Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro was formally re-elected to office on Monday in a highly disputed election. The National Electoral Council announced that Maduro had won with 51% of the vote, defeating his opponent Edmundo González Urrutia. The election has been criticized by multiple global leaders, including the United States, for a lack of impartiality. Claims of voting irregularities were reported as early as Sunday night. Opposition witnesses were denied access to the National Electoral Council's headquarters when votes were being counted. Maria Corina Machado, the leader of the Democratic Unitary Platform, reported that Urrutia received 70% of the votes. Monday evening, thousands of Venezuelan citizens took to the streets in a peaceful protest against Maduro and the election results. Presidential terms in The election marks Maduro's third election to the office, despite public backlash and repeated efforts to remove him from power.
In Congress, members of the Committee on Transportation and Infrastructure are calling on their fellow lawmakers to pass House Resolution 8996. It would implement sweeping reforms aimed at improving railroad safety in the aftermath of the East Palestine, Ohio disaster. Nadia Romlagan reports.
Ohio lawmakers are asking Congress to address long-standing safety failures of Class 1 freight railroads to prevent disasters like last year's massive train derailment in East Palestine. House Resolution 8996 would require that rail companies employ a second crewman and implement a confidential reporting system, among other reforms. At a recent hearing, Ohio Republican Representative Michael Rooley of Youngstown said the East Palestine derailment has caused irreparable environmental and economic damage. He said the legislation would require companies like Norfolk Southern to ensure hazmat expertise on board is shared with on-scene responders, which one of the chemical companies, OxyVinyl LP, did not do.
OxyVinyl manufactured the chemicals on board the train in East Palestine. They recommended not to vent and burn the contents of the train, but this recommendation wasn't shared with first responders until after the fact.
After the Norfolk Southern train derailed and exploded, known carcinogens, including vinyl chloride, were released into the air, soil, and water. East Palestine residents immediately reported experiencing nosebleeds, rashes, throat and eye irritation, vomiting, and difficulty breathing. Many report lingering health problems more than a year after the accident. Federal Railroad Administration Administrator Emmett Bose said the agency has been supportive of the legislation, in addition to conducting inspections on high-hazard flammable train routes.
For over a year, the Department of Transportation has continued those calls while concurrently taking important actions to make freight rail safer.
According to federal data, there were 952 Class 1 train derailments in 2022, with about 77% occurring in rail yards and 23% on mainline tracks. This is Nadia Romlagan for Ohio News Connection.
An art exhibit in Seattle is showcasing the remaining members of the endangered southern resident orcas off the coast of Washington. The whales are struggling, especially from a lack of prey. Eric Tagadoff has more.
An art exhibit in Seattle is highlighting the dire situation of orca off the coast of Washington. The show Superpod All Together features all the members of the endangered southern resident orca pods. Artist Gabriel Newton painted the whales in acrylic on 45 pieces of wood found on the shores of the Salish Sea, where the whales travel and feed. He says the whales are struggling to hold on.
It was inspired by wanting to raise awareness around the plight that they're in and the lack of food that they're experiencing, and to motivate people to take action to help the orcas recover.
There were 74 members of the Southern residents left when Newton started the Superpod project, but a recent population analysis found there are only 72 left. Newton says removing dams on the Lower Snake River would allow more Chinook salmon, which are the whale's main food source, to travel to the Pacific Ocean. The exhibit opens at the A&T Gallery at Seattle Center on August 1st. Dr. Deborah Giles with the organization Wild Orca says the lack of prey is the biggest issue for the southern resident orcas. She says drastic action is needed to save them, including curtailing fishing to ensure they have enough food.
These whales are not recovering, and they're not recovering because we're not taking serious enough action with regard to fisheries management. That's the bottom line.
Newton says it's critical to save the killer whales and salmon, not just for them, but for us as well.
Anytime a thread in the web of life is broken, our own capacity to thrive is reduced. And I view orcas and salmon as both very integral threads.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Democrats have propelled Kamala Harris to the top of the ticket in this year's presidential race. But nationwide, the number of women running for office in November, both as Democrats and Republicans, is down. As Roz Brown reports, that follows three cycles of historic firsts for women elected to office, including in New Mexico.
Earlier this year, Mexico elected the first woman president in the country's 200-year history, and Kamala Harris hopes to duplicate that milestone in the U.S., but a group that studies how women fare in elections says it's still an uphill battle. Harris already is America's first female vice president, and the first Black and South Asian American to hold the office. Kelly Dittmar with the Center for American Women and Politics says in addition to gender and race attacks, Harris will face criticism for her style, with some claiming she's not presidential.
We've also seen attacks on Harris's qualifications, something more common to women and especially to women of color, whose competencies are more often questioned, while for white men, they are more often assumed.
In 2020, New Mexico became the first state to elect all women of color to its House delegation. The group included Democratic incumbent Representative Deb Haaland, who now leads the Department of the Interior. Center Director Debbie Walsh says the number of women running for federal office has fallen off nationally in both political parties. That follows numerous successes, especially at the gubernatorial level.
Women have been essential to flipping the most competitive seats in recent election years, and women of color have been winning both statewide executive and legislative seats in states and districts with majority white electorates.
The last two New Mexico governors have been women, Republican Susana Martinez and current Governor Michelle Lujan.